This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, it's Georgia Hargreaves here with you from now until one, broadcasting on digital today from Karratha in the sweltering hot Pilbara. Temperatures in northern WA are expected to reach the mid to high 40s today in some areas. You'll hear from the Bureau of Meteorology on the heatwave after 12:30, but stay tuned because you're also going to hear from the head of a heat stress consultancy firm who'll be talking about managing heat stress in agriculture and mining. And if you're like me, you probably ate a few too many red cherries over Christmas. But have you ever tried white cherries? Stay tuned to hear about the odd-looking variety that Southwest growers are saying is starting to win over consumers. 12:06 on the Country Hour this afternoon. Now, former chair of the state's main grain handler, Wally Newman, has nominated as a candidate in the upcoming CBH Group District 4 member director elections. He says his extensive experience makes him the perfect candidate for a seat at the table at CBH, which is rumoured to be the target of a corporate takeover. The takeover speculation first appeared in Brad Thompson's article in The Australian about a week ago now. And in that article, he suggested CBH was concerned Macquarie Asset Management might have its sights set on the co-op. CBH says it has not received or provided any proposals regarding corporatisation, and the co-op has declined to provide anyone to discuss the issue any further. CEO of WA Farmers, Tredor Whittington, says Macquarie would definitely have run the ruler over CBH, but at this stage, the percentage of eligible growers required to vote and approve a takeover is set too high. And Trevor Whittington thinks it's unlikely to get over the line.
Macquarie are chasing Cube, which is one of the big freight logistics handlers. That's an $11, $12 billion deal. Cube also owns Port Kembla and New South Wales and move about 3 million tonnes of grain and about half the containers, about 300,000 tonnes of containerised grain. So they are in the sights of Macquarie or hunting them at the moment. Macquarie's also got 5 or 6 or 7% of GrainCorp, which also has another 7 ports over east and moves about 12 to 15 million tonnes. So Macquarie's obviously interested in grain logistics. Where they go for the linking it to CBH might just be flying a kite. The bar's incredibly high for CBH. You've got 2,000 or 3,000 members. You need 75% of the vote. Macquarie, they're smart players. They've been around a long time. And there's no share registry, so they've got to get hold of that first. There's no creeping buy-in, which is your normal takeover strategy. There's no board structure, which you can go and load up the board. And, they'd run into the state government like a freight train, literally a freight train. And then you've got to keep the growers on board because the growers were just, it's not an airport, but there's no other airport, so just buy a truck. We've heard nothing from CBH. We've heard nothing from Macquarie. CBH board would be doing the right thing, going, oh, well, there's something happening over east. We'll get the smart people wrapping their head around it, which is CBH board's responsibility. But you look back at Macquarie's track record of what they buy and what they sell, very hard to imagine that they would be interested in CBH, particularly when they're still trying to, try to buy Cube, trying to buy GrainCorp. Maybe it's the time of year when strange stories appear in the media, but then, Brad Thompson, the journo, is a very good journo.
CEO of WA Farmers, Trevor Whittington there. Former chair of CBH, Wally Newman, doesn't know if there's a takeover bid in place or not, but he says in his experience, where there's smoke, there's fire. And he thinks the co-op could benefit from his prior experience with co-ops and takeover bids. The Newdigate farmer spent 20 years on the CBH board and was chair between 2014 and 2020. His term wasn't without controversy, though, with former CBH board member John Hassell calling for Wally Newman to quit over a 2018 investigation into his inappropriate behaviour towards several women. Wally Newman says it was the growers who encouraged him to nominate for a seat on the CBH board.
I think it was compliments of Brad Thompson in the article that he wrote on corporatisation, which suggested that there was a possible takeover of CBH, and I had heaps of calls encouraged me to put my name down, so it was a last-minute decision, and I feel obligated to offer my services because I've been through two takeovers in my time, and I've certainly got the experience, and that was what convinced me to put my name down.
What have you heard, though? How confident are you that there are discussions going in the background to launch another takeover bid for CBH?
From my experience, where there's smoke, there's usually a bit of fire, and the Grange champions, it was sort of smoke 18 months before anything came to fruition. So it's always an attractive target. So, look, I don't know whether there is or whether there isn't. I don't think anyone does for sure.
Are growers you're talking to concerned about that?
Well, they wouldn't have rang me if they weren't concerned, and they're looking for experience, and the current board, compared to the boards that I sat on, doesn't have a lot of experience. When I went into CBH, most of the directors had done 20 to 30 years on the board and knew it as well or better than the management, because they had such a lot of experience, and after 20 years, there's not a lot that I haven't seen in CBH, and there's some unfinished business there that could be tidied up, just making it more fairer and equitable for the growers.
In what way?
I'm concerned that the current growers are really paying a high price for the use of CBH because they're putting all the capital in, and those capital works will be there for 50-plus years with trains and wagons and infrastructure. And under the old toll system, you lent money to CBH in the form of a toll and you got it back in 10 years' time. So today's growers, if a part of the current charges is a toll, today's growers in 10 years' time will get that portion back. So when they leave CBH, instead of getting $2 back for their $2 share, they'll get, for the following 10 years, the tolls back that they paid 10 years ago. So it spreads the costs of capital works over a greater span of growers.
So you think it's time to go back to that toll system?
It was such a good system. It worked really well. And instead of CBH borrowing money from the banks, they're actually borrowing it from the growers, and they can pay interest on those tolls if they've got surplus funds, and legally get funds back to the growers because it's a loan that they've borrowed from the grower.
Why did they get rid of it then?
It was something to do with making it difficult to corporatise CBH because those loans have to be paid out. So it was driven in about 2003, I think they closed it down. They tried to say that it was negative neutral because you paid out 10 years and after 10 years it's negative neutral, but you're getting the lender the money for no interest, or if you elect to, you can pay interest. So it's very flexible. It makes the co-op a lot more attractive and the structure a lot more smarter and fairer and equitable for those that use it.
Well, if you're looking to get money out of the co-op, maybe it is time to put it on the market and corporatise it.
Well, you'd need to sell your farm at the same time because you'd never make a profit, because whoever owns the five ports in Western Australia will have total control of the industry because we're 90% dependent on exports.
Former chair of the CBH Group, Wally Newman, speaking to Belinda Varischetti about his decision to nominate as a candidate in the CBH Group District 4 Grower Director election. It's 12:15. This is the WA Country Hour. And Wally Newman is the only candidate to nominate outside of the candidate assessment panel process for the upcoming election, and says he didn't have a chance to go through the process because his decision to nominate was very last minute.
Oh, I didn't have it in mind to be a director on the board at that time. It's only just in recent weeks, or since Brad's article came out, that I've had a lot of pressure asking me to nominate.
So do you think that's a disadvantage?
I think if you look at the process and the experience that I've got, then I think they'll realise I actually drove that process. I set it up, so I know what it's about, and I'm sure I've had as much experience as Simon, and he sits on the board and he's only been there half the time that I have, so I should have learnt more than Simon during the 20 years that I've been there, with two takeovers and all the things that we've introduced in that time. So really it's just experience that growers say they're looking for.
And you do have a lot of experience, you know, 20 years with the CBH group.
Yeah,
but there was some serious issues that you faced as well. In 2020, you faced serious allegations during a bitter CBH election campaign. You were accused by an election competitor of releasing misleading company information about its Asian flour milling investment and using that information to try and win the election. And then prior to that, you were accused of acting inappropriately towards women and were subject to an internal 2018 investigation into your behaviour. How do you gather grower support with that track record?
Well, CBH have a very thorough whistleblower policy, and it was used by a fellow director, and it was used, in my view, to undermine myself. And if someone challenged your integrity, then I stand down, and that's what I did until I cleared my name. And in April last year, I got an apology from John. I haven't published it because I know what it's like to be through that process, so I haven't published it, but I certainly have an apology, and John's apologised, knowing that all the allegations had already been investigated and there was nothing to answer for.
At this point then, Wally, you are convinced that that issue is behind you and it's settled?
Yeah, absolutely. John has given me an apology, admitting that everything was dealt with at the time through the proper processes, and there was nothing to answer for, and that what resulted from that process was that the whole board did training in political correctness. So it was the whole board that did the training, and in this day and age, it's changed a lot from when I first went on the board, and for the better, hopefully.
What changes would you like to see at CBH?
I've certainly got some changes. I'd like to see the toll system reintroduced to make it more fair and equitable. The CBH grain, I've got some concerns, particularly when they took profits from CBH grain to prop up storage and handling. How can CBH grain pay the very best prices if they're subsidising the storage and handling, and only 43% of the tonnes generated those profits? So the other 58% of growers who sold to other traders, them traders didn't contribute anything to storage and handling. So it's about being fair and equitable, and not having any free riders in the system. Free riders are the biggest cause of co-op failure in American history. I did a course over there at Missouri University, and they go through all that sort of stuff. So I've had a lot of training on co-ops in my time.
Why didn't you make those changes, like the toll system that you're a fan of, during your tenure as CBH chair?
At that stage, you've got to have support of the board, and I can't change it on my own. I can put it to the directors, but I've got to have 7 out of the 12 directors have a good look at it. And there are other mechanisms that you can use within co-op structures that I'd like to see investigated to try and get it so it's more fair and equitable. Why should today's guys fork out huge amounts of dollars for capital items like trains and wagons and storages that are going to be around in excess of 50 years, and the guys that come in down the track get the use of those without even contributing towards them. So it's about trying to make the whole system fairer, equitable, and when you leave CBH, you're going to get a little bit out of it. It's not going to set the world on fire, but it's better than $2.
Is this process of looking for more grower return from an investment in the co-op a stage that all growers kind of reach as they get towards the end of their careers and looking for some sort of retirement windfall?
I think it's from today's growers worried about that they're footing the bill for the growers 10 years down the track. That's certainly how I'd look at it. Why should a grower today be forking out for huge amounts of capital for someone 10 years down the track that's not going to contribute to it at all?
What do you think about the sale of the flour mills, the recent announcement to sell those?
Very concerned, because that was put there specifically to generate profits to lower growers' charges and to leverage the balance sheet. The balance sheet's hardly leveraged at all, and it's not been run like a proper business. And when you've got such a huge balance sheet, it makes it very attractive for a takeover, whereas if you've borrowed to buy assets that generate income and there's a big loan there, it makes CBH less attractive to take over.
And the competition that we've seen in recent years here in Western Australia, what do you make of that? Is that set to continue?
I think that's really started from when CBH Grain started to put profits into the storage and handling and haven't been able to compete on a fair basis because they're subsidising other parts of the business.
How do you rate your chances, Wally, of winning a seat on the CBH board?
Put my name up on the grounds that if I get in, I get in. If I don't get in, I won't be too worried, but at least I've offered, and I've offered my knowledge and experience, which is considerable, probably the most experienced grower in Western Australia, certainly as far as co-ops go, that's able to do the job. So I've put my name up, but if growers elect to vote for a young guy that's needs to learn all that stuff and it's going to take 10 or 15 years, well, that's what they've got to make the decision.
Newdigate farmer Wally Newman speaking to Belinda Varischetti. Wally Newman will compete for a seat on the CBH board in District 4 against the incumbent Royce Taylor from Lake Grace and Clayton Smith from Wagen. The election results will be announced following the counting of votes on Monday the 23rd of February. I'm keen to hear your thoughts on what you've just heard this afternoon. 0448 922 604 is the text line. And also let me know what you think about the rumours of CBH being the target of a potential corporate takeover. 0448 922 604 is the number. This text has just come through from Dee, who says, do not let the multinationals get hold of CBH. There is nothing positive to be gained for WA growers and will result in lesser service and higher costs. Listen to Wally. He talks sense. Thank you for that text, Dee. It's 23 past 12. You're listening to the WA Country Hour. Now, heading further south of the state now, over the weekend, the popular South Coast holiday spot, Windy Harbour, was inundated with fishermen searching for a new place to fish following the state government's ban on demersal fishing along a large stretch of the WA coastline. At its peak, 70 to 80 boats and trailers packed into the town of Windy Harbour, raising concerns about ageing infrastructure, marine safety, and the future of the town as fishermen make the move south. Shire of Manjimup President Donnell Bugie says the weekend was a real eye-opener about the challenges ahead.
So this was our first really good fishing day in Windy Harbour since the ban. It was quite a strong indicator of what the challenges may be going forward. Obviously, parking was a real issue down there. We do have the ability to expand the car park. We don't have the funding, but we do have the ability to expand the car park. So I think it's going to be very interesting going forward, and we have to be very mindful of how we approach this with the local residents in mind as well.
And you sort of just mentioned parking, but infrastructure and toilets are another thing. How are they coping with the number of people now, and what issues have already emerged on the ground down at Windy Harbour?
Toilets, showers, fish cleaning, waste disposal. Our rubbish disposal down there is, it's literally a 6x4 trailer that gets towed away to a transfer station. So we are going to have to look at that. The infrastructure that's down there is aging, and it doesn't have the capacity to facilitate for the amount of people that are coming down. So that is going to be a real priority, and that will be a very strong part of the request going into the state government for further funding.
Have any safety concerns come up? Have you spoken to Marine Rescue with the influx of the amount of people out on the water and sort of the amount of volunteers that they have?
Yeah, so the Marine Rescue is a volunteer-based organisation, and they are amazing down there. They are so dedicated, but it is a weekend volunteer base. And we know that these fisher people that go out, they do go out through the week. So we will not have Marine Rescue through the week. They will have to travel from Manjimup, Pemberton and the surrounds to be able to get the boat out if anything happens. There is a concern with the amount of parking, about where those emergency services vehicles would park when they got there, because it was very full on the weekend. And that was, I think that was probably the least amount of vehicles that we will see going forward. We are very prepared to support the Marine Rescue in any sort of further resources that they need to be able to cope with this as well.
And have those conversations been had with the Marine Rescue and sort of other surrounding places for during the week and maybe ramping up patrols?
The difficulty of it is these volunteers have normal jobs. So they are very conscious of having a roster going forward. It is a little bit of a suck and see at the moment to see how many people are going to come through the week, what the limitations of the Marine Rescue are going to be. But of course, we will continue working with them on that.
The Shire has asked for $10 million in funding for upgrades last year. Has there been any response from the state government, and what's changed since then?
I had reached out to Minister Punch and Minister Jarvis over the weekend. I have spoken to Minister Punch and I have a meeting with Minister Jarvis. We will highlight what that $10 million would be potentially spent on, what the needs are, and what the ramifications of this ban are for the local ratepayers and leaseholders within Windy Harbour, and what that could potentially mean for them.
And what are residents and local businesses telling you about how this influx is affecting their daily lives and services?
So Windy Harbour is a really unique little settlement. There's no shop in Windy Harbour. We had a couple of food vans. So there was an ice cream truck and there was a coffee van that had gone down there for the weekend, which was fantastic for them. They were really busy. But it's probably going to be Pemberton and Northcliffe that are really going to feel that coming through, which is fantastic for those two towns if they utilise those people coming through. But Windy Harbour, it's a little settlement. It is gravel roads. It's quite intertwining roads. The way into the boat ramp goes past a playground. So there are a lot of things that we really need to take into account if and when the amount of traffic really increases going through Windy Harbour.
Do you think the state government underestimated the real world impact on the small coastal community like Windy Harbour?
I think fisher people are really passionate. This is what they love to do. And I think anywhere, having not being able to put their boat out in other places, they were going to find somewhere to put it out. And Windy Harbour is that place that you can do a day trip. One of the people I'd spoken to, they'd left Busselton at 2 o'clock in the morning to be able to launch their boat and go out fishing. I don't know if it was underestimated, but we really need to get that point across that this is a real world problem and we need to address it as fast as possible.
And if this does continue over the next few months, I mean, we have Easter coming up, what do you think will be the biggest challenge facing a small coastal town?
The biggest challenge facing Windy Harbour is actually going to be the increase of people in the settlement. This is a really quiet little seaside little settlement that people go, the kids walk down the streets, you know, they're free to do what they want to do. It's a really tiny little settlement. So the biggest impact is going to be the amount of people that are going through Windy Harbour and trying to maintain that coastal feel that the people, the residents down there have bought to enjoy, and balancing that with the amount of people that are coming through.
And I guess what is your message to fishers who are planning to come down to Windy Harbour when that surge does happen?
Just be patient. Everyone's down there to have a great time. Make sure that your safety equipment is up to date. Make sure someone knows that you're going out and when you're coming back in. Be mindful of the conditions and please be mindful of the local residents. This has been quite a shock on them. They're used to having Windy Harbour all by themselves. So it's going to be a shock. And I would just like implore that everybody just be mindful of everyone else.
Manjimup Shire President Donnell Bugey speaking to Rachel Boothman about the influx of fishermen over the weekend, all searching for a good spot to drop a line in the water. And this is, of course, following the state government's ban on demersal fishing from Kalbarri to Augusta, which came into effect on the 1st of January. As a result of the ban, Windy Harbour is the closest boat launching site southeast of the affected area. Fisheries Minister Jackie Jarvis says 80 boats and trailers at Windy Harbour at this time of the year is not unusual.
So look, I live in the southwest, and I've been told by lots of people that that's pretty regular at Windy Harbour in January. It's school holidays. I'm meeting with the Shire of Manjimup. They own and operate and control that boat ramp. If they've got some data to say this is unusual, but I'm certainly being told that it's not unusual in early January for there to be a lot of boats at Windy Harbour, as happens up and down the coast.
Infrastructure is said to be a big cause of concern for the Shire in Windy Harbour. Is that something you're working to fund?
The Shire of Manjimup only raised it with me a few weeks ago. I've said I'll meet with them. There's been lots of funds where the Shire of Manjimup can apply for funds, whether it was through the forestry transition. I mean, it's interesting. The Shire of Manjimup said when we did the native forest transition that tourism would not help their economy. And now they're saying that we've got too many tourists in our local government area. It's a little ironic. Look, I'm happy to meet with them. But as I said, they've never raised an issue with me before. This is a new issue. But I'm told that I'm told by people that regularly visit Windy Harbour, this is not unusual for this time of year. If they've got some data to say that it's unusual, there's lots of mechanisms where local governments can access funds for infrastructure.
With those reports of the 70 to 80 boats and trailers, the topic of safety has been raised because there's only volunteer marine rescue on the weekends in Windy Harbour. Is that a concern to you?
Marine safety is a concern for everyone. There are lots of country towns where we have volunteer marine rescue. So, I mean, as I said, I haven't seen any data to show that there are more fishers in Windy Harbour in early January than there have been any other year.
WA Fisheries Minister Jackie Jarvis speaking to Jess Baker there. And make sure you tune into the Country Hour tomorrow to hear the full interview with Jackie Jarvis, who's going to be addressing a range of concerns that have come up in the last couple of weeks about the impact of the permanent ban on demersal commercial fishing. It's 28 to 1, time for an update from the newsroom. Charlie Mills is here with the headlines. Hello, Charlie.
G'day, Georgia. An 18-year-old has appeared in court charged with murdering a man in suburban Perth on Christmas Eve. Gaivena Singh is one of three males charged over an alleged stabbing attack on a 19-year-old in Auburn Grove. WA has recorded more than 2,000 monthly housing approvals for the second month in a row. Figures released today by the Bureau of Statistics show the state's seasonally adjusted volume of approvals in the third quarter increased by around 73% compared to the same time in 2023. In this metric, WA beat all other states and territories by a margin of at least 35%. A group of Australian intelligence and security experts is calling for a federal royal commission into Islamic extremism and the rise of anti-Semitism following the Bondi massacre. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese now appears open to the idea of holding a Commonwealth inquiry into the mass shooting after weeks of resistance. And salmon companies have started using antibiotics in more pens in southern Tasmanian waters to combat a bacterial disease that caused mass mortality last summer. More news at Georgia coming up at 1 p.m.
Thank you for the update, Charlie. It is 27 to 1 on the WA Country Hour. Now let's head to the Bureau of Meteorology. Luke Huntington is here today. Luke, let's start in the Southwest Land Division. What's on the radar?
So today across the South West Land Division, it is fairly quiet. We do have a ridge developing south of the state. It's keeping temperatures pretty much sort of average through most parts of the South West Land Division. So the highest temperatures are only reaching sort of the mid-30s in the northern central wheat belt, and maybe around the high 30s in the inland central west today. In terms of sort of any precipitation, maybe just a chance of a thunderstorm in the very far eastern parts of the South West Land Division. So we're talking about around the Israelite Bay area east of Esperance this afternoon. But even if that were to occur, there wouldn't be too much rainfall in that. So dry lightning would be a risk. But it's a very small area for today. Heading into tomorrow, we do see a weak cold front just brush the southwest coast. So there could be a chance of a shower between Augusta and Bremer Bay, mainly probably tomorrow afternoon, but it should be less than a millimetre or so if they did get any rain. And we do have sort of a little bit increased heat over the northern parts of the southwest land division, pretty similar to today, really. Still high 30s in the inland central west, so around that Mullawalmora area, and the northern central wheat belt getting up into the high 30s, so a little bit warmer for tomorrow. In terms of any thunderstorms, we don't have anything forecast for tomorrow over the southwest land division. Heading into Friday, in terms of temperatures, we do see sort of a southeasterly change push right through, so significantly cooler for the wheat belt area, mainly in the high 20s, maybe nudging 30 in the very far north, and the inland central west going back into the mid 30s or so. So a little bit of a milder change. And in terms of precipitation, it doesn't look like we're going to get too much. Maybe just a chance of a light shower along the south coast and the onshore flow, but not too much around. And then for the weekend, we do have just at the high moving south of the state. So we'll probably see some gusty easterly winds developing through most parts. In terms of temperatures, we're still staying on the milder side through most parts, but still remaining in the high 30s over the northern parts of the central west district. Even Geraldton's going back up to around 37, 38 degrees. And in terms of precipitation, there's just a chance of a thunderstorm over the northern parts of the central wheat belt. So that would be sort of dry lightning associated with that if that were to happen. And maybe just a very slight chance of a shower over the central and eastern parts of the southwest land division, but not too much in it. And then on the final day, Sunday, again, it's a little bit uncertain. The trough is deepening off the west coast, and there could be a little bit of shower and thunderstorm activity around. But at this stage, we've got the thunderstorm staying over the northern parts of the wheat belt and into the very far eastern central west district.
And it's getting hotter as we head further north, isn't it? What's the story in the northern and eastern forecast districts?
Yeah, so over the north and east, we do have a heatwave warning current over the Pilbara, Gascoyne, Goldfields and South Interior. So that's a severe heatwave. It does look like it eases by Friday, but it's still going to be pretty hot. But in terms of severe heatwave conditions, that should ease on the Friday period. We are seeing temperatures through those areas, through the Pilbara especially, in the mid-40s and even the high 40s through the inland parts from Onslow there. So we do have around 48 or 49 degrees forecast in those inland parts, not affecting any sort of towns or anything, but that's still pretty hot.
Wow, and, yeah, it is.
Yeah, it is, yeah. And so the Gascoyne, even in the Gascoyne, we're going for many places into the mid-40s through the northern parts there. We've got Meekatharra there at 44 for today. In terms of thunderstorms, the north and east today, we are going for thunderstorm activity right throughout the Kimberley, the northern interior, and then throughout most of the Pilbara region, extending into the northeast Gascoynes, right throughout the Goldfields region and into the Eucla. So we could see some damaging wind gusts around those areas. So if there are any wind gusts reported. We will put out a severe thunderstorm warning with that today. But most of the rainfall should be around the Kimberley area, but we haven't seen too much rainfall through there in the last couple of days. So maybe 20 to 30 millimetres in a storm. They are expected to move pretty quick, so that'll decrease the amount of rainfall. But other areas probably more likely seeing less rainfall with dry lightning a possibility. Heading into tomorrow, a similar thunderstorm area right throughout the Kimberley, Pilbara, interior, and just contracting to the northern goldfields tomorrow. Again, there could be a damaging wind risk in parts of the Kimberley and Pilbara region, with most of the rainfall happening through the Kimberley. As we head into Friday, similar thunderstorm area again. Heading into the weekend, we are expecting thunderstorms right throughout the Kimberley interior and Pilbara and northeast Gascoyne. Again, a lot of the rainfall occurring in the Kimberley area. And Sunday, similar area again, probably just the thunderstorms extending a little bit further south into the southern Gascoyne area. And as I mentioned, the temperature's slowly decreasing later in the week, but it's still going to be pretty hot through that southwest Pilbara, with temperatures remaining in the mid to high 40s through that area.
Very hot indeed. Thanks for the update, Luke. It is 20 to 1 on the WA Country Hour. Now, due to today's risk of fire, there is a total fire ban in place for the local government areas of Ashburton and Exmouth. Obviously, during a total fire ban, you can't do anything that could start a fire. If you're not sure of what that means you can and can't do, you can find a full list on the Emergency WA website, as well as a map of the affected area. And remember, it's your responsibility to check with your local government if there's also a harvest and vehicle movement ban. So just repeating, today there is a total fire ban in place for the local government areas of Ashburton and Exmouth. Now, in terms of rainfall for WA, in the last 24 hours to about 9 o'clock this morning, there hasn't been much at all. In the Kimberley, Sturt Creek recorded 21 mils and Halls Creek Airport recorded 4. And there was nothing over about 2 millimetres recorded anywhere in the Southwest Land Division. Well, with multiple heatwave warnings in place today in areas across Australia, there is no doubt it's hot out there. The Pilbara town of Paraburdoo is getting up to a whopping 47 degrees today. But of course, work on the farm, on the station, or on a mine site doesn't stop just because it's hot. That's what led reporter Fiona Broom to ask some pretty important questions about what the colour of your wheat says about you.
It's barely 9 o'clock in the morning. You've already been hard at work for a few hours and you're drenched in sweat. This time of year, it can feel impossible to cool down or quench your thirst while you're on the job. So what does that say about what's happening in your body?
Well, clearly your body temperature is elevated, and that's what the sweat is all about. Now, going to the toilet and seeing a dark-coloured urine is a sign that your body is low on fluids. It's losing a lot of fluid out of your skin through the sweat.
The Public Health Service Health Direct has produced a handy little chart that ranks the colour of your wee from clear to brown to help answer the question, am I drinking enough water? Occupational heat stress specialist Dr. Matt Brearley says once you find yourself in the yellowish middle of that scale, you're starting to get dehydrated.
Yeah, you're starting to lose substantial fluid, or you're not keeping up with your fluid needs by that point, which can be a real challenge for people working in the field. It may require a large fluid consumption, which is sometimes hard because lack of availability, or you're just not used to drinking that much. So it can be a real challenge doing physical work in our conditions.
Is hydration just about drinking water? It might be a bit of a silly question, but does drinking water, is that enough to stay hydrated?
Generally, yes. I mean, food is critical for heat stress management. That's something that's not well recognised both in workplaces and in the general public. Food provides the fuel to allow us to do our work, and it also contains this thing called electrolytes. Now, most people have heard about electrolytes from sports drink companies or companies that are trying to market a certain drink mix to you. They tell us they have lots of electrolytes and you need them for your hydration. They don't tell us that our food has way more electrolytes.
Is brown whey or a dark yellow coloured whey the only sign that you might be experiencing heat stress, or are there some other signs?
Most people assume that hydration equals heat stress. So if I'm dehydrated, well, I can fix my heat stress by just being hydrated, but it's body temperature. So body temperature is the main issue while working in the heat. Dehydration, in my opinion, is a supplementary or secondary issue. It influences heat stress, but does not determine it.
At this time of year, all across Australia, it is hot. There's sort of no getting around that. If your job requires you to be out in the paddock, out picking fruit or veg, working outdoors in any way, how can you stay on top of heat stress?
So we've got to get rid of this body heat you're producing. I think the key thing to remember is that we are all just like internal combustion engines. We all produce heat. The harder we work, or you could look at it as the harder we rev our engine, the more heat we produce. In cooler weather, this is less of an issue because most of that heat can readily be lost to the environment because it's cool. It might be dry air, and it takes that heat through sweat and through radiation of heat. When it's hot, humid, sunny, etc., that environment doesn't accept as much. So we either have to slow down to produce less heat, or we have to cool the body as a way of getting rid of that body heat.
Is there a demographic within the agricultural industries who are more at risk of heat stress because they either won't or don't know how to manage heat stress?
Yeah, look, the ag industry is really interesting because in general public, we'd say it's the young. We'd also say the elderly because they've lost the ability to dissipate heat, chronic disease sufferers. These are the type of people we're generally most concerned about in a public health setting. But when it comes to ag workers, I think the resiliency of the workforce and the fact that we generally won't put our hand up no matter how hard the conditions are, how hot we are, that resiliency is something that I think is amazing, but also see it as detrimental in heat stress management. So if we are not willing to put our hand up, I'd say the whole industry is at elevated risk. But within that group, we would definitely say people who have less of a voice, who don't have the ability to convey their heat stress, to talk about it. We could be talking about visiting workers, workers on short-term visas, et cetera, workers with English as a second language, maybe less willing. We see a lot of data from the US where migrant workforce suffer more heat stress, and they don't really voice that unless through research.
You have worked on stations. You've been a station hand. Your research in the field of heat and our bodies has taken you to all the hotspots in Australia. What's the hottest place you've been?
It's not on the surface. It's kind of a manufactured environment because it's in hot, humid underground mines. These mines are very deep as they chase the ore, whether it's gold, copper, etc. And the rock face underground of that, at the depths we're talking about, is in the high 40s, and you have to wet everything down because of the dust, and it's pretty tough. So having lived in the tropics, I thought that was it. This is the hottest that it can get. It's more tropical in those underground mines, so they're very, very tough to operate in.
Well, if you are above ground, in the water, below ground at this time of year, what are your top tips for dealing with the heat?
So it's body temperature, body temperature, body temperature. It's this the key, and we don't talk enough about it because most people go straight to dehydration as the cause and the remedy to heat stress. And a lot of people, and even in those underground mines, which are amazing place to study heat stress, a lot of the crews I work with across their 12-hour shift will drink in excess of 10, 12 litres per shift, which is around 1 litre per hour. And they'll still pass their hydration tests and still feel terrible at the end of the shift. When I say terrible, I mean they'll be fatigued due to heat, have a headache, they'll feel this irritability, some may be nauseous. It's like a alcohol hangover, but due to heat. So they'll suffer this heat hangover despite being hydrated because we're not addressing their body temperature. So we have to cool down. while working in the heat. And for most of us, it's a foreign term because we just get on with the job. But if you look at the best athletes in the world, they rest on the bench during their performance, even though they're trying to win a medal, a premiership, etc. They know, and the coaches know, the value of dumping body heat and going again. And I think the best way we can manage ourselves in the heat is to address body temperature by cooling regularly. We do better work when we're cool. We're more efficient at it. I think that's the big change for the ag industry, in my opinion.
A very important message there, especially today, with it being so hot in parts of WA. That was Dr. Matt Brearley. He is the Managing Director at the heat stress consultancy Thermal High Performance, and he was speaking with Fiona Broom. It is 11 minutes to one.
The WA Country Hour with Georgia Hargreaves on ABC Radio WA.
Well, mango harvest is in full swing in the Gascoyne. Eddie Smith grows just over 3,000 mango trees on his property in Carnarvon. And he says this season is shaping up to be even better than the last. And he's expecting to fill thousands more trees.
Oh, we started on the 26th of December and we're probably about 40% through the crop now. It's amazing. The timing, I was expecting it to start a bit later, but it started a day before when we started last year. So the variables, and yeah, the mango season's in full swing and we're working hard.
So when do you know when to start picking? Like, when do you know today is the day to get out there?
The shape of the fruit, the colour of the fruit, the colour of the flesh inside the fruit is a real major gauge. And the bricks count that gets done on the fruit tells us that we're ready to go.
How's it going?
Good. The weather hasn't been too bad. We had a really hot day. I can't remember what date it is now. They're all rolling in one into the other. But the rest of the time, it's been in the low 30s. So the weather's been exceptionally good this year for us. So the weather-wise, it's been pretty good. Workforce has been good. So no real complaints at all.
Perfect. Well, my next question, Eddie, was going to be what challenges have you faced this season? But seems like it's all been pretty smooth sailing.
Other than there's a few of the little challenges that come by now and then, you know, having Christmas Day, Boxing Day, and the New Year, it impacts the truck movements, the freight. So freight's been a bit of a challenge at times, but other than that, yeah, it's been pretty well, yeah, smooth sailing.
What sort of troubles have you had with freight?
Just getting a regular service over that period. The Christmas New Year period is pretty difficult to achieve, you know, and I understand, you know, people don't want to be working; they want to be with their families. But we're dictated to by the fruit, and if the fruit's ready to come off, we've got to get it off and before it falls on the ground, and then we've also then got to get it moved on into the market.
Yeah, the fruit is your boss, Eddie.
Yes, it is. Unfortunately, yes.
How is it looking? What's the quality like so far?
The quality's up on last year and the numbers are up a little bit on last year, so the quantity is up as well. All in all, so far, so good.
How many trays are you hoping to fill this year, Eddie?
We'd be happy if we get our 15,000 trays.
Is that what you had last year?
No, last year we did just over 10,000 trays.
And what are you hoping for next, Eddie?
The weather to remain mild while we do our pruning and all the other work we've got to do in preparation for next year's crop.
Carnarvon mango grower Eddie Smith speaking with Amelia Searson. And Eddie says he expects to finish picking mangoes by the end of this month. It's 8 minutes to one. You're listening to the WA Country Hour online, on digital and on the ABC Listen app today. Now, you may have been eating plenty of red cherries over Christmas, but Southwest growers say there's another variety worth tasting. White cherries may look underripe to the untrained eye, but some say they're some of the sweetest fruit around. The premium Royal Rainier variety has been grown in Manjimup for nearly a decade now, and this season it's finally starting to win over WA consumers. Ray Guadagnino manages Guadagnino Orchards and says the cherries thrive in the region's cool nights and mild summer days. But they're also one of the most challenging crops he's ever grown.
This particular cherry, the Royal Rainier, we planted them probably 10 years ago and have only just started taking off now. And most people look at it and say, oh, yeah, it's a bit green. But once they bite into it, they say, well, there's a really good cherries and stuff.
When people bite into these white cherries or the Royal Rainiers for the first time, what should they expect in terms of flavour and texture and colour and that sort of thing?
The crunch, straight up, is the crunch that you get from the cherry, but then you get that sweetness of it, and it's like, just look at people's expressions on their face, go, oh, that's a lot sweeter than a normal cherry, and it's true, they are a lot sweeter. They're my favourite. I love them. I just absolutely love them. As I do, I love all the cherries, but this is particularly my favourite, and it's a European cherry, so over in Europe, that's basically all you see is a white cherry. Very rarely you see the red ones. You do see a few from Spain that rock into the, you know, UK and stuff, but the Royal Rainier is, yeah, one of the most underrated cherries in Australia at the moment, but we're trying to push hard to promote it, and it's working. It has worked, actually, so, yeah.
Some people are saying that these cherries are pretty hard to grow. What makes them more difficult than the red variety, and what are some of the biggest challenges you face as a grower?
So the biggest challenge for us is this one. If it rains and they are like turning that colour, that light red colour, if it rains, we're in trouble. It does split the cherry. So what it does, where the stalk is, the rain or the water sits on top of that stalk there, and the cherry absorbs the water and it blows them like popcorn. So a few weeks ago when we had those thunderstorms up Perth and all that rain that we had down south, down here, so my son-in-law Adam and myself, we started blowing the water off the trees. It's like our spray units, but it's a dry blow. So we'll go through and blow the water. So we started blowing about probably 8:30 at night, and went through until about, what, just after 4 o'clock in the morning to get the water off. We saved the crop, like we saved a majority of it, but if we had left it, we would have lost the majority of them. So it's one of those things where you got to do it. It's just, yeah, they're a hard cherry to grow, very hard, extremely hard. It's hard, but look, it's rewarding. At the end of the day, it's rewarding to see people smile when they bite into the cherries and that. So, yeah.
Yeah, amazing. Do you see white cherries becoming a regular southwest crop, or do you think that'll always be a bit of a specialty product?
It's a specialty product. It's a specialty product, and I think what's happening is the unknown of this cherry. See, a lot of people think of it as, oh, you know, it's not ripe, but if they just try it, and then they'll say, well, it's a good cherry. We've noticed, like in the last 4 or 5 years, how common it's become, and not only the cherries, even the figs as well. The younger generation, more so, the younger generation are getting into this cherry.
Ray Guadagnino manages Guadagnino Orchards down in Manjimup, which is in the state's southwest region, and you heard him there talking to Rachel Boothman about white cherries. Apparently they're becoming more popular for buyers, and that variety is called Royal Rainier. It is 3 minutes to one. You're listening to the WA Country Hour.
Hello, I'm Annie Guest. Join me for The World Today. The United States discussing ways for acquiring Greenland. The White House saying military force is always an option. Most states and territories facing heatwave warnings as temperatures soar in Victoria and South Australia. And all aboard the Elvis train, fans head to the iconic Parkes Elvis Festival. Those stories and more coming up on The World Today at lunchtime.
Now, 7,742 sheep and lambs were penned for sale at the Katanning market today. That's down 6,487 on the last sale of last year. Terry Birkin, how was the yarding today?
The sale consisted of several lines of well-finished shorn lambs with a lot of feeder weights down to lines of very light frame merino lambs to return to paddocks. Values remained equal to last year's final sale across all lamb and sheep categories, with most regular processor and feeder buyers in attendance, along with several seasonal restockers. Very plain light frame store lambs under 12 kg carcass weight range from $30 to $75, while bigger frame stores up to 16 kilos carcass weight sold from $104 to $177 a head. Light lambs were selling from $150 to $210, while trade lambs returned $194 to $240, and heavy lambs from $218 to $262 a head. Merino store weather hoggets returned $80 to $130, and heavy weights from $139 to $180, while merino ewe hoggets sold from $80 to $154 a head. Crossbred hoggets showing condition were selling from $140 to $209, while good young rams sold to a top of $175. Bony ewes were selling from $50 to $162, while medium weights returned $160 to $201, and heavy ewes sold to a top of $220 a head. Most mature rams sold from $50 to $190, with restockers bidding to $221 on a selected pen. This is Terry Birkin for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks for running us through those numbers, Terry. And it's almost time for the news, but first I'll quickly read out a couple of texts that have come through in reference to the influx of fishing boats being reported at Windy Harbour. Mike in Pemberton says, "Hi, what about the flogging of the fish?" Thanks for that text, Mike. And this one has no name on it, but this person says, "I call for a $40 million investment in jetties and boat ramps over that south area." Thank you for sharing your thoughts this afternoon on the WA Country Hour. It's always appreciated. For now, it's news time, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.